So good evening. Manly, you're making me hungry. Let me say that I have no conflicts, first of all, in this presentation. In the latter part of 2010 and all of 2011, I chaired an Institute of Medicine committee called Living Well with Chronic Illness, and it's really a call to public health action. The cover looks like this. It's available at National Academy Press. If you want to purchase it, purchase the paper copy, but you can download the report in its entirety at no cost if you're interested. So the sponsors were the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Arthritis Foundation, and so I just want to draw some lessons from this along the way. When the IOM does a report, it generally stays at arm's length from the sponsors for reasons you can probably guess. But in the end, and I'm a CDC veteran anyway, we know a lot about them, but it was very important to talk to the Arthritis Foundation when it was all over, and you learned a lot. And I think it's really those of you who are involved in chronic disease control need to hear from the professional and advocacy organizations, and they have a lot to say. That's very important. So let me go on. So here are the goals of the report. Let me just say fundamentally that what we were asked to do was to try to improve control of chronic disease as a public health commodity, if you will, and particularly state and local health departments, which is CDC's one of CDC's, of course, primary constituencies. So we focused on a number of things, and I really can't spend a lot of time with any of it. It's a report that doesn't have a punchline, but it has what we hope is a lot of good advice and summarizing and ideas to be tested. And among them, and I'll come back to these, including all chronic illnesses to a greater extent, not only the great killers that Manly just showed to you. It included a life course approach. It included health disparities. It included surveillance issues, the complex interactions of public health and chronic disease management as it takes place in the healthcare system, and an emphasis on the quality of life. And so all of this, it's a very daunting and complex area, as you all know. And so we did what we could do. So let me start with which diseases should we study? There, by implication, the sponsors said, well, you know, there are a lot of important diseases out there, and we've been doing heart disease and cancer and obesity and diabetes and so forth, and all of that's to the good. It all needs to be done. And so in part the implication was, why not give us the next five or the next 10 lists, and instead we took a little bit of different, we took a different approach. So after the second bullet, I just want to say how many different ways there are to prioritize chronic illnesses. Again, you can read them for yourself, but you could look at those that are most disabling. You could look at those that, of course, have the highest mortality. You could look at those that have high economic costs, those that are preventable, those where the population fears the consequences the most, and what the community wants to take care of. So all of these are really in some ways orthogonal to each other. And so we decided to take a little bit different approach than just doing the numbers as it would be done in epidemiology, only because there are so many different dimensions in doing the numbers, as I've tried to point out. So we took what's called an exemplar approach, and we decided to look at what are the consequences, what are the health consequences to a patient and his or her family or social network when chronic illness occurs, and we listed all of those, and then we basically selected a sampling of diseases that would cover most of that as possible, most of what we could do. So here are the exemplars that we chose. You may have different ones, and that's fine. we did think of the diseases that have had less attention, arthritis, not merely degenerative arthritis, which is the most disabling illness in our population, but also the inflammatory arthritides as well. Cancer survivorship, to look at the social domains of living with chronic illness, chronic pain, which is a symptom and not a disease, dementia being associated with aging and neurodegeneration. We wanted to deal with mental illness, and so it won't surprise you that we selected depression. We did look at type 2 diabetes. We also looked at traumatic and post-traumatic disabling conditions, schizophrenia, because we wanted, again, to represent mental illness, which tends to get left out of the discussion, if not out of our feelings, and then finally, sensory loss. So we took these not because they're the things that need to be done, but because there are actually about 20,000 rubrics in the ICD, and all of them have their advocates, and all of them are different from each other. And the largest, the disease burden is not heart disease, cancer, and stroke. It's really other. Okay. So we wanted to be inclusive, and that's the reason. And so this is, we have a prioritization scheme that I think probably for the sake of time I'll just skip. But it does deal with the social issues and the disparities and the different ways, in fact, of choosing priorities in terms of chronic disease control. One of the areas that I said we would talk about is surveillance. So surveillance is very important. We basically argued, and CDC was already beginning to do this anyway, to expand the clinical descriptors of illness, to go beyond diseases to symptoms and function and quality of life and surviving with diseases, and even the adverse effects of clinical and public health interventions. I've always felt that there were adverse effects of community intervention programs. Okay, I don't know whether you believe that or whether you've thought about it, but I was pleased to see that the community guide, for example, that CDC puts out actually has a gesture to it, if not a lot of suggestions. Let me give you one quick example. So it's well described in the pediatric literature that children come home from school when they've had their anti-smoking lecture and are crying and sad, and they go to the doctor, and the pediatrician notes that the kids are afraid that their parents are going to die because they're smoking. So I believe that that's an adverse effect of an education program, and we at least ought to think about it. We don't even know how to ask the questions, but I think they're out there. Another part of surveillance that was very important is longitudinal assessment. Now, for the most part, the BRFSS, as you may know, and the National Health Interview Survey are cross-sectional surveys. They're one-time surveys. They're very important. We learn a lot from them. They've grown over the years. But I think it's important to go back to the same people. You have a chronic illness. You have a certain amount of disability or symptoms or whatever. What's happened to you a year later? If we don't know the outcomes of chronic illness, then we really can't make policy. And so it's arguing for an extension, in essence, in epidemiologic terms, doing cohort studies. We also want to know whether patients, it's very important to know whether patients with chronic illness are participating in chronic care management. And this is a complex story, but it needs to be told. We also spent some time with multiple chronic conditions. I'm particularly interested in older people. This is a current policy of Health and Human Services to emphasize multiple chronic conditions. A typical elder has three or four of them, not one. And so the question is, when you're controlling something in which there are two other or three other illnesses on board, how do you do that, and do your public health interventions actually work? And that's really a tough question, because the evidence, in fact, isn't really there. There was also an issue with what is prevention when you begin to unpeel the layers of chronic illness. So, of course, you have primary prevention, but in a certain sense, most of the patients with chronic illness in this country, all of them, by definition, are beyond primary prevention of that particular illness. But the question then is, will primary prevention work for people who already have an illness, or two or three or four? And the answer is, in general, we don't know. Do the public service announcements for dietary behaviors or smoking or whatever, do they actually reach people with chronic illness? We need to know much, much more about that, in fact, than is out there. And then even secondary prevention. Should you screen patients with one disease for another disease? Well, if you go to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, you won't find the answer to that because they don't ask that particular question. I like what they do. I'm a veteran of that, too. But in fact, we really don't know the answers to those things. So there are lots of questions about what is primary prevention when you already have illness, what's secondary prevention, and what's tertiary prevention, which is also called rehab. Again, we wanted to call, as those in chronic disease control are involved in, a renewed emphasis in community-based interventions. We think they're really important, but again, do they reach the right people and in the right way if you already have an illness? And as I said, I don't think we know the answer to that. We need also a renewed emphasis on interventions that deal with self-management and some of the things that we don't think of as preventive, respite care for caregivers, peer support, disease management from the healthcare system, self-management, taking care of yourself, treatment adherence, and lots of things that we don't really know enough about that, in fact, we need to learn more about. Jim Marks and others will talk about policy issues, but we did spend a good portion of our time on policies. Who are the policymakers? What is the policy at the federal level? How can we change any of this? Will policies deal with all the sorts of things that happen to people with chronic illness, independent living questions, policies such as the Americans with Disabilities Act? And finally, policies, well, of course, none more than the Affordable Care Act, which we're living through right now. And so how do we deal with all of that? We tried to answer some of those questions as best we can. We wanted to extend public health interventions to the workplace, and we think that's very, very important. And there's a particular need, as many of you know, for low-wage employers and small businesses to try to bring not just primary prevention in the conventional sense, but also prevention and health programs to working people in small industries where there are no programs, there are no health professionals, there are no not even often insurance. We argued for greater use of newer economic methods in the public health domain, and we went into that in some depth. And I'll just go over this. And then finally, we argued that I think maybe among the most important things that we had to say was collaborating among public health, prevention, and community sectors. In essence, I think it's a hackneyed term, but things are basically siloed now. There are health departments that are bravely doing chronic disease management in diabetics and others. There are more that are still trying to do the primary prevention, which is fine when you have limited resources. We don't argue with that at all. But what we are arguing for is that sooner or later, health departments and formal public health agencies are going to need to get together with the healthcare system, even if it's the local healthcare system, and work out a way to make sure that everyone is attended to. And in fact, in some ways, don't let the healthcare system dump on the health department some of the roles that really should stay within the healthcare system. Okay, and it's a very complex area, and we have a model for that, which I won't take you through because I'm being warned right now. And so this one that you can see in the report is actually the most modern one. These models of combined public health and healthcare system action started with Ed Wagner and his colleagues about 15 years ago, maybe, the chronic care model, and it's evolved over time to include the community more than it has before. So let me leave it at that. I just wanted to show you the names of the people who really did most of the work, and there they are, and here are maybe you know some of them, and here are the study staff at the Institute of Medicine who did this. So I'm going to stop and would love to answer questions when we come to that part of the program. Thank you so much.